The shootings in Texas and Ohio could have ramifications on Florida's future gun laws. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. One South Florida Democrat even called for a special session in order to tackle the gun control debate. We'll hear from State Representative Javier Fernandez about how the conversation on guns could play out in the next session. Also,
and I felt that it was really important to educate these kids. They need to understand the dangers of oversharing, the long-lasting effects.
Christine DiMattei talked with a local author, a mother who wants to help parents protect their children from cyberbullying. And finally, today WLRN aired its new radio documentary called Chartered. WLRN's Jessica Bakeman looked at the only district in Florida that is entirely charter schools. She'll share with us some of the challenges of spending 3 years reporting on the story. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, Florida's legislative session begins in January of next year, and until then, lawmakers will meet for committee weeks. Now, the first of those will be in mid-September. Some House Democrats wanted to call a special session ahead of time focused on gun reform. It was in response to the mass shootings in El Paso and Dayton. South Miami Democratic State Representative Javier Fernandez led that effort, and he joins me now in studio. Representative Fernandez, a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Why did you want a special session on gun reform?
Look, I think it's the topic of the day, frankly, in the wake of what's happened with El Paso and Dayton, yet another reminder of the work to be done on this issue. And 60 days in the typical session, a very constrained period of time on an issue like this that's touches upon mental health and general violence in communities. I thought we don't have important work to do in the fall during committee weeks, but certainly we could make the time to try to tackle this as a standalone issue and give it the attention it deserves.
Isn't it something that would have been discussed during committee weeks, something that you can do during that time?
So, I will applaud the Senate President, Bill Galvano, for indicating that he's going to begin to workshop some of these issues. But in the House, our leadership has indicated no appetite to discuss these measures. And, you know, last session was disappointing to see not less than 9 bills filed by Democratic members, none of which got a hearing. And I think the issue was no less urgent there then than it is today.
You know, I mean, I hate to say this because it's become the norm. I mean, granted, we had 2 shootings within a 24-hour period. But, your reaction after that, is that when you were thinking we have to talk about this now?
We've been talking about it. We've been trying to talk about it for the whole session. I think it's just, you see, from my perspective as a state legislator, Tallahassee has a role to play in addressing and providing solutions to this issue. We've been part of the problem for the last 2 decades, liberalizing our gun laws to the point where guns have become so readily accessible that you're seeing the impact it's having on our kids. As the availability of weapons has increased, kids have unfortunately borne the tragic consequences of the proliferation of guns and additional injuries and increased deaths over that period of time.
You know, so for this special session, exactly what did you want to tackle? How did you want to go about it?
Look, we wanted to focus on what we thought were 6 common sense gun reform proposals that have, by our estimates, widespread support across the state, starting with universal background checks, which are supported by more than 76% of all Floridians. We also wanted to talk about limits on large capacity magazines, get out of the discussion about banning assault weapons, which is a rabbit hole in of itself, and just focus on what allows these weapons to become all the more destructive, which is large capacity magazines that give a shooter the ability to project 30, 40, 50 rounds at a time, limiting those magazines to 10 rounds, for example. Talking about the need to revise our concealed carry permit standards, have an active a live fire requirement for that, reduce the term of those, because so much can change in the life of a permit holder in the span of 7 years, which is the current period. Also talk about the need to have proper storage for guns. We see a lot of these deaths, 60, I think something like 45% of all deaths among children or shootings related to children are a result of the lack of proper storage and handling of weapons. Also modifying our current red flag law, one of the good proposals that came out of the legislature after Parkland, to allow family members to also seek a risk protective order to make sure that if someone is a risk themselves or others, they can take away their weapons for a limited period of time to determine their mental health.
When you ask for this session, though,
yeah.
I mean, you have a Republican legislature,
yes,
and a Republican governor. Did you think that you were going to get it?
No, I think our expectation was to, again, highlight the issue and really, allow for another moment engaged with the community, a community that's desperate for these reforms to take place, and really set the tone and the stage for the session by demanding that these issues be considered during our next working session.
Let's talk about the last session. Co-sponsored a few gun-related bills, the measure to ban the sale for or possession of assault weapons, large-capacity magazines. Those died in committee. You had a concealed carry in child care facilities proposal as well. What happened?
That all of those proposals, none of them had a hearing at any level in any committee. So they were filed and never taken up on any agenda. And so that's what we want to see change this coming session. You know, our community is desperate for solutions. We've got plenty of proposals on the table, most of which I would tell you, I think all of which are well-meaning, well-intended. Surely they could use some refinement. What we want is a conversation, a serious conversation about tackling this issue.
All right, let's get to this part then. What is that conversation to have? You mentioned polls. All right, there's the Quinnipiac poll that says more than 70% of Floridians want the government to do something on gun violence, but it doesn't say what that something is. So what is the conversation that we should be having on what the government, what role the government can play in this issue?
Well, we started with the six proposals in this special call because these are six areas where I think there's widespread public support for reform. Universal background checks. I think there's very little debate that every transfer, every sale, with the exception of a small minority of Floridians, 76% of Floridians, again, poll tested, want to see us set that up as a requirement for the transfer of any firearm. The same is true of large capacity magazines. Storing of weapons. People understand that if they're going to have a gun for protection of their home, they should take adequate measures to either store that in a safe or have a trigger lock mechanism on the gun so it can't be used by someone who is mentally ill or a child in an accidental shooting,
so
for example.
As you've mentioned, and I had pointed out to the poll that, a majority of people want to see something done.
Correct.
And yet again, after no matter how many shootings, the government seldom ever passes anything of significance. It's not to say after Parkland there were some changes, and I do want to point that out. But I'm just wondering, what's going to happen next?
Well, look, I think the other part of this conversation that gets overlooked is the day-to-day carnage that happens on our streets. There's communities like in Dade County, like Liberty City, Overtown, Goulds, Homestead, Florida City, Miami Gardens, that deal with the ravages of gun violence every single day. And these things come with a substantial cost, not just in terms of the lost opportunity in the lives of the children that are hurt by the majority of these gun crimes, but also in a direct hit on our state treasury. We subsidize about $75 million of the $100 million in care given to kids that are injured by gun-related accidents every single year. So, that's, to put in perspective, we provide zero funding in terms of capital improvements for our public schools. That's $75 million more we could redirect to that purpose. That's half the money we're giving charter schools to improve their public facilities.
Parkland survivors and activists have proposed a nationwide gun control plan. Part of it is, again, a ban on assault-style weapons, raising the age to buy guns from 18 to 21.
We've done that here in Florida.
Also some other things as well, but I'm wondering, that's on the national level. That's what they want to see pressed in D.C. But is this a battle we have to wait and see what happens in D.C.? Or do you think that you can move the meter here in Tallahassee?
Well, that was part of the reason for the call. I mean, I think, we have all become very federally focused. Part of that's because we had a change in leadership in the federal House and the passage of a universal background check bill there and the optimism that the Senate might also take action. But Tallahassee can be part of the solution because it's been part of the problem. Whether it's not acting on the proposals that we mentioned or passing laws that preempt local governments from taking common sense measures to curtail gun violence in communities, those are things that we can reconsider and talk about in an upcoming session.
And how do you feel about local governments making that decision? We've seen a couple of cities say, hey, we want to ban assault weapons. The state push back and say, no, we make those rules.
Yeah, I think I understand the desire to have a uniform marketplace, but I think that by having a one-size-fits-all solution, we hurt the rights of gun owners, right? Because these issues play out very differently in different communities. Gun violence in Miami-Dade is very different than what happens in Alachua County or Polk County. And so I think we should respect the wisdom of our local elected officials to take the necessary action to rein in some of the worst forms of violence.
We're talking with South Miami Democratic State Representative Javier Fernandez. He led the effort for a special session on gun reform ahead of the state legislature's committee weeks. That's about to start in mid-September. Again, the special session did not happen, though. For years, the NRA lobby in Tallahassee is very powerful, led by Marion Hammer, and she's had a strong foothold there. After Parkland, it seemed like things were starting to switch. But I'm curious, how do you describe right now what that influence that the NRA and Hammer have in Tallahassee with lawmakers?
You know, I think it's waning, but it's going to require persistent public pressure to really eliminate that influence. And so, you know, again, a call like this, at the end of the day, we knew we didn't have the numbers. But we've got to continue the consistent engagement between sessions, before sessions, during sessions, highlighting this issue and the need for action. If as a community we rest on our laurels, we rest on the sentiment that exists today, what's happened historically is that the pressure builds and it wanes. And in that kind of a condition, Ms. Hammer and her legion of supporters win to the detriment of our community.
And, you know, her latest argument, by the way, is that if we push forward a constitutional amendment, because there is one right now they're trying to get on the ballot for next year, that would ban assault weapons in Florida. She argues that hurts the gun manufacturers here in the state. It's a big economic business for the state. That's a lot of jobs. This is the approach she's taking. Okay, the economic ramifications. What do you say to that?
Well, we have economic ramifications we're dealing with today. The cost to our treasury in terms of healthcare we're spending directly out of Medicaid and kid care to deal with gun violence in children and adults. There is the lost opportunity, the opportunity cost associated with the lost lives because of gun violence, the fear, the local expenditures on law enforcement, the outlays that our local governments have to make to further arm their police personnel, you know, giving them assault-style weapons as well to combat the high-powered firearms they're facing on the streets.
I mean, it almost sounds like we have to pick one or the other.
We have to pick one or the other. I think there's the time for half measures is really long past.
This comes to this bigger debate, I think, where you have one side that believes greater restrictions will equal safety. But you have the other side to say, wait a second. First of all, it's our constitutional right, but that more guns may actually mean better safety, that I could protect myself. Do you see that? Do you think that's the divide right now?
I think that's part of the divide. I think it's also a narrative that the NRA has very well fostered over the last couple of decades. You know, this good guy with a gun theory. You know, arming teachers was about as foolhardy a solution as one could find. You know, the one issue I take with the Parkland Commission's work is they didn't even quote a FBI study that looked at active shooter situations from 2003, I think, to 2013. And in the 40-some-odd incidents that happened in that time period, there were 26 engagements by law enforcement with an active shooter. And in those 26 situations, there were about 28 deaths that resulted with, you know, highly trained law enforcement professionals that were engaging that shooter. And, you know, for every officer that was killed, there were two that were injured in that exchange. So expecting better results from our teachers, I think, is not sound policy, certainly not supported by the facts and data that I've seen. And I think what we need to understand is nothing that we've called for in the special session, certainly nothing that I want to propose in any way is intended to curtail or be a derogation of the rights of law-abiding citizens to own a gun. But what we do need is safety measures to make sure that if a person possesses a gun today, they continue and has the extraordinary privileges provided by a concealed carry permit, they remain of sound mind, right, to continue to exercise that right. We need to make sure that when firearms are transferred, that the person who's getting them is someone who does not have a history of domestic abuse, et cetera.
How often do you get to talk to gun owners, though, and ask them about their take on some of these ideas you have?
You know, when I put out the poll, I started getting trolled by a couple of people who are, you know, are active gun owners. And, I'm directly engaged with them. And I mentioned what I want to do with respect to concealed carry permits. And when I explained the proposal, they had no issues with it. And I think that's true. That'll be true probably with most of the engagement we'd have on this issue with gun owners. They understand the risks. They understand the responsibilities attendant to gun ownership and the rights that they possess. And I think at the end of the day, everybody wants to live in a society where if you have a right, it comes with attendant responsibilities. Because again, the consequences of inaction here are extraordinarily high.
For the upcoming committee weeks, again, that starts September 16th, what do you think the conversation is going to be like on guns in the House and Senate?
You know, I'm hoping it'll go beyond the mental health realm of the discussion. Certainly an issue that we need to consider as part of the solutions that we promulgate. You know, we also need to consider funding adequately our public schools and the support personnel that have been decimated over the last 15 years of reduced funding cuts, or funding cuts that don't keep pace with inflation. You know, my short example would be, my mother was a school guidance counselor for the last 22 and a half years of her career here at Miami-Dade County Public Schools. And at the beginning of her tenure, she spent 75% of her time giving direct service to students. And by the end of her tenure, she was doing more paperwork than anything else. And so I think we need to reinforce those resources in classrooms to deal with the mental health component. But at the end of the day, there's a statistical correlation that's very clear. The more guns that are available, the more injuries and deaths that result.
Are you concerned, though, at all, that every time there's a shooting, you know, that both sides just go to their corners and stand their ground, and there is no conversation and nothing really gets done? And of course, they keep saying, well, there's just more shootings, and they just keep happening.
Look, I think we need to engage. And I'm happy to have, and any of the members on the other side who know me, and they know me, some of them know me well, know that I'm someone who wants to find a middle ground and a compromise. But not having the conversation is not acceptable any longer. We need to have the conversation. We need to get in a room, black, white, brown, whatever faith, whatever part of the state we're from, and try to understand a solution to these issues.
Let me finish with this. I mean, the session is in January in 2020 because of the election. And because of the election, I wonder, what role do you think guns are going to play in this upcoming session?
I don't think the issue is going to go away.
Is that going to go away, but do you think it'll be a prominent issue? Again, considering it's a big election year.
I think it's going to be a very prominent issue. And I think the president's backtracking on a proposal as widely supported as universal background checks recently, you know, based on conversations and pressure apparently from the NRA, is only going to feed the activism on the part of folks that want to see reform happen.
Again, talking with South Miami Democratic State Representative Javier Fernandez. Again, the legislative committee weeks begin in mid-September. And, of course, we'll also be following that legislative session to see what they're going to be fighting for over those 60 days. Representative Fernandez, such a pleasure. Thank you.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having us, and thanks for your coverage of the issue.
Definitely. Well, still to come, a South Florida mother wrote a book on helping parents and their kids deal with cyberbullying. That's coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, you know, we all make mistakes. And in the age of social media, ever-present smartphones and surveillance cameras, nowadays it's too easy for those embarrassing, reckless moments to be shared with everyone. Because of that, it's increasingly hard for parents to guide their children through a social media landscape that can quickly turn from likes and innocent chats to cyberbullying or worse. Now, those issues and more are at the center of a novel called Somebody's Daughter by Miami-based author Rochelle Weinstein. The book made the summer reading list of at least one South Florida high school. And in the acknowledgments section of the novel, attorney Elisa Amico is prominently mentioned. Elisa is co-founder of the Cyber Civil Rights Legal Project. Her pro bono work helps the victims of what's become known as revenge porn. WLRN's Christine Diamante spoke with Rochelle Weinstein and Elisa D'Amico recently. And just a note to our listeners before we begin, this discussion includes adult content that parents might feel is not appropriate for young listeners.
Rochelle, at the root of Somebody's Daughter is a sexual indiscretion at a party that's captured on cell phone video. It goes viral, and a teenage girl and her family are plunged into sheer chaos. Why was it important for you to tell this story?
I had teenage boys at the time when I wrote the novel, and I saw the landscape of the oversharing and the digital technology and the dangers involved. And I felt at the time that we were not educating our kids properly. I felt that the kids today, the internet is it's not real to them. It's abstract. And as parents, we're giving them the keys to this digital kingdom that we don't know a lot about. And I felt that it was really important to educate these kids. They need to understand the dangers of oversharing, the long-lasting effects. And not only that, there was another very important piece for me, and that was the piece of compassion. We've just become a very numb society, and we need to be a little bit kinder when kids make mistakes.
In the book, this happens to a wealthy family. Why did you set the book in a world of privilege as opposed to a middle class or even an impoverished family?
I try to build the book around this perceivable perfect family because the whole point was this could happen to anybody. You know, people view these privileged families and nothing can go wrong and they have these wonderful lives. But I felt that the bigger piece was it can happen to any of us. Somebody's daughter could be any one of our daughters. And while we try to do our best and we navigate and there's no real blueprint for parenting, kids mess up, no matter who they are, no matter the demographic, no matter their socioeconomic status.
Alisa, Somebody's Daughter includes a character very much like yourself. Actually, I read the book and you are just spot on. You're absolutely that lawyer in the book, a lawyer who specializes in cybersexual harassment. How do you and Rochelle know each other?
Rochelle is married to the managing partner of my law firm office, the K&L Gates Miami office. So I've been working there. October will be 10 years. And we have forged a great friendship over the years. So when I found out that she was writing about this subject, it was near and dear to my heart. And we spent some time on the phone talking through the different sort of permutations and combinations of what could be and what could become of the characters in her book.
Revenge porn is an important theme in the novel. Alisa, please describe for us what it is exactly.
So revenge porn, or non-consensual pornography, is the non-consensual sharing of intimate media, so photographs or video, without consent of the pictured individual.
So basically betrayal of trust. You know, often it happens that two people are in a loving, seemingly trusting relationship. They break up. Before they broke up, when they were still together, there were images taken, maybe nude photographs. And after they break up, one party uses those photographs against the other. Is that the most common scenario?
That's definitely one of the common scenarios. I think they fall maybe into three buckets. So there's the sort of revenge situation that you're talking about, where it's someone that you were in a relationship with, whether it's a husband or a wife and they break up, or, you know, boyfriend and girlfriend. And that's probably what people think about when they talk about revenge porn. We've moved over to using the phraseology of non-consensual pornography because a lot of times there is no revenge aspect. The other situation is when the photographs were not taken with consent. So whether it's pinhole cameras or being photographed without your knowledge while you're sleeping, women who are unconscious and have photographs taken of them, or a friend is photographing a rape or something where the individual didn't even know that there were photographs. So the last situation is where the photographs were taken and stored on someone's own devices. So whether it's the iCloud or on a hard drive or on their computer. And these are photographs that may be photographs documenting losing baby weight or after breast cancer surgery, some reconstructive photographs.
And they get hijacked.
And it could be sexual photographs or videos as well. I mean, I'm not in the business of judging.
Now, in the book, the predominant emotion, I would say, is bewilderment. How could this happen to our daughter? How could we have prevented it? Now that these awful images are plastered all over the internet, what can we do about it? Alisa, when this happens in real life to one of your clients, what legal recourse do they have?
Oftentimes, it's really difficult to put all of that stuff back in the box once it's out. And that's because of the speed at which the information travels and how quickly people can download it and share it. If we're able to act quickly, we can often effectuate change and try to remove some of the materials, and in some cases, all of the materials. But a lot of times, and I can say this with certainty, that most of my clients have one goal, and that's to remove the materials. It's not to punish the other person. It's not necessarily to have them arrested or to make a huge amount of money from them. They just want it down because of the effect that it has on their lives. It just stays with you. One of the first things we do when we meet someone or we're about to meet someone, whether for a date or in business, is you throw their name into the search engine and see what comes up. And when the first page or two pages is sexual videos, it's really hard to get a boyfriend, get a job, keep a job, stay in school. And in some cases, it drives individuals to suicide. So it's really critical that we pull that information down. So sometimes we're able to remove the actual materials. Sometimes if we can't remove the materials, we can remove the search results that show up on search engines. So there are built-in tools.
Rochelle, you have a lot in common with the mom in your book. You both live in Miami. You're both the mother of twins, but yours are boys. And much is written about the double standard that lets boys off the hook but subjects girls to what is known as slut shaming. As the mother of boys, what more can be done in our society to raise boys to have healthy and respectful attitudes toward girls?
Well, I'll tell you what I tell my own children. There is no tolerance for disrespecting women, period. We have regular conversations with our children about respect for women, safety, online safety, sexual safety. And we believe in our family, information is key. Giving them the tools, giving them the strategies, teaching them the repercussions. You know, we talked about this book. My kids had a very difficult time with it. They didn't want to talk about the, you know, the sex book. But I felt it was very important for them because this has happened all over. These scenarios have happened all over. And it's not just happening in our backyard. And we saw the shaming and the laughing and the whispers under the breath, not just from the kids, from the adults too. And something that Elisa taught me, you know, there's this misconception that what's wrong with this girl and what did her parents do? And it's not that, you know, they're victims. They're victims. And you have to, and that level of compassion has to be taught. It has to be illustrated. The kids need to actually see it, witness it, feel it, understand it.
I'm speaking with Miami-based author Rochelle Weinstein. Her book, Somebody's Daughter, deals with teenagers and sex in the digital age. Also joining me in the studio is Elisa D'Amico. She's co-founder of the Cyber Civil Rights Legal Project. And if you're a parent, we want to hear from you. How would you respond to finding pornographic material on your child's phone? There are times the internet and social media can be monumental, empowering things for teenagers. Most notably, I mean, look at the Never Again movement launched by the student survivors of Parkland. But it's an ever-changing landscape. Elisa, how well are laws regarding the internet and social media keeping up with the advancing technology in protecting children's bodies and identities?
Let me say this about law and technology. And it's sort of a broad statement, but I think it's an important one, is that technology advances way more quickly than our laws. And even if we were to think up all of the laws that we needed, the process for getting laws passed is a slow one. It takes a while. And so by the time you're able to get laws passed, often the technology has sort of kicked ahead. And so there are laws in place that certainly protect children. But I think this is an ongoing battle for everyone who is using the internet to think about where the gaps are, where the holes are. I mean, we see this every day with the Internet of Things, right, with social media platform liability. And there's a big debate and there's a big sort of clash now over whether platforms and internet websites should remain immune under federal law, because they are. This is Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act. And whether individuals should be able to hold those platforms liable for information that's on there.
And how about law enforcement? As an attorney yourself, you deal with law enforcement. Do police departments get it?
I've worked a lot with law enforcement, especially in this area. And there are a lot of departments around the country, state law enforcement, that understand the problems, understand that there are laws on the books, and have the resources ready to help victims. Most often, when we're talking about state law enforcement, however, victims find themselves in a game of pinball, and they're the ball. I always tell victims, when you want to walk in there and make a report, if it's something that warrants making a report, ask for someone in cyber crimes and or sexual crimes. A lot of times, that's the same person. But you ask for those people, and they're specifically trained. The law enforcement problem, in my opinion, isn't the problem of law enforcement not wanting to help. It is an education and training problem. They don't really understand the issues from the victim side. And so we've heard, oh, you shouldn't have taken those photos anyway. Oh, you gave them the photos to that person so that he owns them now and he can do what he wants with them. Like, this is all not true. And it's, so my opinion is, it's not a wanting to help. It's a, I don't have the tools to help.
Most everybody has a smartphone these days. What is the one thing that you want to tell the average person that they just don't know, that you wish you could grab everybody in a room and tell them?
The biggest thing is, when you download an app that you believe is free, it is not free, and it is not the product you are. And we're all giving away something for that app, and usually it's information. So my number one and Rochelle and I have talked about this a lot, is it's about information. And this is probably why, if you're like me, that pair of shoes is following you around when you go to search for it. But you need to understand what information you're giving out. Are you agreeing to have your private information sold somewhere? When my children, when they're downloading apps or wanting to get involved with games, I read about them and I try to find out as much information as possible so I can set the right settings up for them or tell them, you know what, you actually can't use this app. I'm not going to let you. Let's try this one instead.
Rochelle, let's go back to the book. Somebody's Daughter ends with, it's a questions for discussion section. And it seems to be more directed at parents than their kids. So what's been the feedback so far from parents who have read the book?
Fear.
That's understandable.
We just recently talked about a friend of hers that finished the novel, and there's tremendous fear. It's difficult for people to read because it's just showing the ever-evolving dangers of technology, and our kids are just so all over it. And I think that all of these parents, they want to do the right thing, and they want to do the best for their children, and they're scared. I think they're realizing that it could happen to anyone.
And the book has landed on the summer reading list of at least one South Florida high school. Such reading lists often include the classics like To Kill a Mockingbird, you're smiling.
I'm laughing.
Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet. Rochelle, tell us why your book deserves to be in that kind of literary company for young readers.
I think it's a real challenge today to get, number one, to get kids to read. And I find that Somebody's Daughter is something that is relatable and informative, and kids today, this generation, can immerse themselves in. Secondly, I feel that it is very important that a school is finally taking note on the dangers of digital oversharing, cybersexual harassment, and I think that they are doing a great job in educating their students on how to be safe online, long-term repercussions, how to stay safe, and also that beautiful kernel of compassion for when they see it happens to somebody, you know, in their school. You know, instead of poking fun, instead of sharing, instead of like ha-ha with the guys in the locker room, wow, that sucks. That could happen to someone I know and love. That could be my baby sister.
When you did find out that it made the summer reading list of a high school, what went through your mind?
I was really proud of my work, and I was really proud of my message, and I could not have done it without Elisa. And I really hope that other schools follow, because it's twofold. I think it's an interesting read for teenagers to see themselves and what happens within their little communities, their digital communities. And I also think that it's an important lesson.
Rochelle, you're tearing up. It's an emotional issue for you. You've written several books. How much does this particular book hit you on a gut level as opposed to the others you've written?
You're going to make me cry. I just feel that I feel very, very compassionate about this subject. And it's amazing to know that you have a message that is being delivered and is making a difference in people's lives.
And that was WLRN's Christine DiMatte talking with Rochelle B. Weinstein and attorney Elisa D'Amico. Rochelle's latest book is titled Somebody's Daughter. Elisa is co-founder of the Cyber Civil Rights Legal Project. And if you or someone you know has been the victim of sexual cyber harassment, here are a few resources for you. Please check out cyberrightsproject.com as well as cybercivilrights.org and withoutmyconsent.org. Those organizations can help you protect your rights, restore your online safety, and connect you with legal help if needed. Well, still to come, one district in the state of Florida is completely run by charter schools. We'll learn more about it from education reporter Jessica Bakeman. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, we are taking a look at Florida's first all-charter school district. It's in Jefferson County. That's a county in North Florida near Tallahassee. Now, that district had struggled with low grades for years, so the Florida Education Department jumped in and made the entire district all-charter schools. The legislature helped with some extra funding. WLRN's education reporter Jessica Bakeman spent more than 3 years researching this district, talking to local leaders and parents and students, and she came out with a documentary. It aired this morning. It's called Chartered, Florida's First Private Takeover of a Public School System. And again, it takes a look at how this school system has been transformed for many students, and it's been good for some people and disastrous for others. It aired again this morning at 9 a.m. It's going to replay again at 7 p.m. on Thursday. And by the way, if you want to, you can find it online at WLRN.org. And Jessica Bakeman joins me now in studio. Great to have you back, Jessica.
Thanks, Lewis.
First of all, listen to it this morning. This is really powerful. 3 years researching, investigating, putting this story together. That's a long time for a story.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, you know, I can't say that I was 3 years ago. I woke up and I was like, I'm going to do a documentary on this. You know, it's like I was reporting on it for that period of time. Before I came to WLRN, I used to work for Politico in Tallahassee, and I mainly covered state government. So I was covering the legislature and the State Board of Education. And it was 3 years ago in the summer of 2016 when the State Board of Education first started talking about, okay, what are we going to do with Jefferson County schools? This district has had D's and F's for a decade under, you know, Florida's system for grading schools. More than half of students in the middle high school had been held back at least twice. You know, there were just some of the lowest test scores in the state. Like, the district was in financial ruin. Like, any way you can kind of cut it, the district was really in dire straits. And so the state education department said, we need to do something to change this situation for the students who live there. There's around 800 students in the whole district, so it's a tiny district. Before, it was only two schools. Now it's been reorganized into three schools, but basically elementary, middle, high. So that's it. It's a K-12 school district. And the State Board of Education didn't give the local school district a whole lot of choice in terms of what they should do to fix the problems. They basically gave them a couple of options and nudged them toward, you know, the charter school option. So that happened, and the legislature did some work to try to help make it happen and ultimately gave some additional funding as part of the Schools of Hope program, which is designed to bring charter schools into neighborhoods where traditional public schools have failed for a long time. And that was part of the reason why this ended up becoming this big project, because the perceived success of the Jefferson County Charter School takeover was part of why the legislature then expanded this law. And we're going to see more charter schools of hope throughout the state, including here in Miami.
You know, I mean, I had the advantage in that I'm working with you. So I see you regularly every week. And I've seen how this project has been fun but challenging for you, taking a toll on you as well.
Thank you, Lewis. But I don't know how I should take that.
Well, I'm wondering for you, what was the greatest challenge? I mean, you started this, as you said, before you came to WLRN. So being way down here, I mean, what was the greatest challenge in putting this together?
Well, you're definitely getting at something important, which is that, you know, well, we say in the documentary, you know, this is playing out in rural North Florida, but Miami is running the show. So part of why, you know, it ended up evolving into the project that it is for WLRN is because there's a huge South Florida component to this story. The charter school network that took over the school district in Jefferson County is called Somerset Academy. It's one of the biggest charter school chains in Florida. Most of the schools are in our counties, Miami-Dade, Broward, Palm Beach, and the Keys. And also, Somerset is affiliated with a for-profit charter school company called Academica, which is also based here, and has been kind of controversial in the education space, mainly because it's a for-profit company, but also because it has close links to some former and current state lawmakers who have made charter policy, you know, charter school policy that benefits charter schools while working in the charter school industry. So that's a piece of the story as well. But I would say, as for the challenge, part of it is being far away from where it's happening. You know, there's not as much of an opportunity for me to, you know, spend time with and connect with the people who are there. And also that feeling of not wanting to come in from the outside and make some kind of statement about, like, this is what this community is, this is who these people are. You know, I really wanted to let the people who live there tell our listeners what their community is like.
You know what? And only because I want to give a little bit of insight to listeners on how we do our job. I think this is interesting, is that a lot of the time with pieces like this, there are a lot of people working on a team to make this happen. It's not to take anything away from the editors and the other people who helped you, but you carried a lot of this. And that seldom ever happens. Again, is that part of why it took as long as it did?
Yeah, I mean, I think like the story continued to change and develop, and so there was good reason to like take some time and see, you know, certainly this documentary is not like a definitive judgment as to how this charter school district is doing. We haven't said it's absolutely a success, it's absolutely a failure. It's only been open for 2 years. But I think part of the reason why that's important to look at is because the legislature and other state education leaders have already pointed to it and said, it's such a success, we should do it again, we should replicate it around the state. And it's only been 2 years, you know? So you can't take something that was in such bad shape for so long and really turn it around that quickly. So I think it did take some time to see how it was going. And also, you know, if people listen to the documentary, if you check out our website, wlrn.org/chartered, you'll see that there's a lot of documents. I read more than 1,000 pages of documents. I listened to hours and hours and hours of public meetings, some of them twice because I was there in person when they happened and then listened to them again later. And then, yeah, I mean, I made several trips up to Jefferson County to do reporting. Like a couple of them were a couple of weeks at a time. And it does take a lot of time in terms of the production aspect to put it all together. So yeah, it's a time consuming process, but I think that it was extremely rewarding.
So the first question that comes to my mind when I first remember you pitching this is I thought to myself, how does an entire district get taken over by a charter company? And you do point it out, but can you say it's one group, one person, one agency that really pushed this to make it happen?
I think that if there's one agency that is most responsible, it's the State Board of Education. So there are laws in Florida that say, so, well, first of all, to take a big picture look, the Florida Constitution is obviously the governing document. It's the basis of all of our laws. And one of the biggest, you know, most important statements in the Florida Constitution is that school boards and superintendents have authority over the schools in their districts. But it also says that the State Board of Education, has the power of supervision. And basically the legislature gets to decide what that means. They get to pass the laws that say, here is how the State Board of Education can supervise school districts, right? So there are state laws that say, okay, if a school district is in financial emergency, the state can step in and temporarily take over budget decisions. If a school district has too many years of D's or F's, or there's too many indicators that the schools are failing, then the state can step in and say, you have to do something drastic and radical to change what's going on here. And it was kind of the perfect storm in Jefferson County because they were in both financial and academic emergency. So it gave the state more power than maybe it has ever had over an individual school district. And being that it's small and being that it's kind of far away from the populous power centers of Florida, it was a relatively easy place for them to say, let's do this experiment. And Somerset from South Florida is the charter school operator, was the only one that applied. So they were the ones who are running it.
And that's how they see it. It's an experiment to see if this could actually work.
You know, a couple of the different people who are involved in the Somerset takeover did say specifically experiment. One of them is like a consultant who's overseeing it. And at one of the meetings, he said, this is a very new experiment for Florida, taking over an entire school district and making it all charter schools. When I talked to the principal, he said, you know, I've heard people call it an experiment. So he wasn't really calling it that himself. But I think certainly it is. Yeah. I mean, it's the first time this has ever happened in Florida. Again, to keep it in perspective, it's a very small school district. We're talking about three schools. Obviously, there are places throughout the state where there are three or more schools that are run by the same charter organization. But the thing is that the way charter schools typically work is the school district where they are located is essentially in charge at the end of the day. Like the school board oversees their charter and they say, okay, if you're not meeting XYZ obligations that are laid out in this charter contract, then, you know, we may not renew it or we can terminate it in like an extreme example. And when you have all of the schools being run by a charter school organization, they just really have a lot more independence and a lot more freedom to do what they want. And in this case, in particular, because the elected superintendent and the elected school board, which were chosen by the voters, were completely sidelined and they were really not able to do the things they wanted to do because the State Board of Education was saying, no, under financial emergency, you can't hire any staff, you can't do this to oversee it. They basically have free reign.
Again, talking with WLRN's education reporter, Jessica Bakeman. This morning, her documentary series called Chartered, Florida's First Private Takeover of a Public School System premiered. It takes a look at Florida's first all-charter school district. It's Jefferson County. The district was engineered by unelected state bureaucrats and funded by the legislature. And again, it looks at how it's been transformational for some students and disastrous for others. And we're talking about how this experience might already be changing education throughout the state. You can listen to the full documentary online, again, WLRN.org/chartered, or you can check the rebroadcast again Thursday at 7 p.m. You talk to a lot of different people for the series. Let's hear from a couple of them. There's Andrea Boland, I believe. She's a retired teacher, former president of the teachers union that doesn't exist there anymore, and her husband is a school board member. Let's hear her.
It wasn't the will of the voters. I mean, I think the voters found out about it after it happened. And so I think it's totally obliterated local rule. How can a locally, democratically elected official not have any power?
It kind of goes to what you just said a second ago, but what's her greatest concern here?
Well, I think she's talking about the loss of local control. So again, like I said, the Constitution says school boards, superintendents have authority over the schools in their districts. Local control is something that people in the education world see as really important. It's like you want to have a say in what happens with the school that's down the street that your kids go to. And obviously, education is not that simple anymore. But her point is, you know, the voters elected people to lead a school district and they have no power. Just kind of a funny anecdote about this particular interview. So unfortunately, all five members of the school board in Jefferson County declined multiple requests for interviews over more than a year. But when I was in Jefferson County, I was like, well, I'm here. I might as well give it another shot, try again. Obviously, reporters are annoying, persistent. But I just called their house because this is a small school district and the house phone number is listed on the school district's website. And she answers the phone and I'm like, oh, you know, I'd like to speak with school board member Charles Boland. I'm doing this story about the charter schools. And she's like, oh yeah, he'll talk to you about that. And then she like yells to him and he's like, no, I don't want to talk to her. And she's like, well, would you like to talk to me? Because I used to be a teacher. I was a, you know, the president of the teachers union, and I'd love to talk about it. You can come over right now. And I was like, okay. So I went over there and then he answers the door and she didn't tell him I was coming. So he's like, who are you and why are you here? And I'm like, I'm sorry, this is awkward, but your wife said I could come. But anyways, she was really an interesting person to talk to because she's a longtime member of the community, obviously knows the school district after having been a teacher there for her career. And she felt like, you know, this charter school company is coming in from the outside, from another place. And they're telling us, you know, what to do. And, you know, some people in the community saw that as a really good thing because they felt like the district desperately needed a culture change.
And some of those people, again, you talk to a lot of different people. You talk to students as well. There was one called Anthony, and we're only giving you his first name to protect his privacy. He was in eighth grade when he got arrested during a fight on campus at Somerset Jefferson. After the fight, he said that he was inspired to change his life. Let's listen.
Somerset just gave me a chance. Like, I used to be a bad student. Like, they seen good in me, so they gave me chances, and like, I started playing football. I feel like now they see that we not really dumb kids that everybody thought we were. Like, I want to make my mom proud and be the one to go to college and stuff and help my family out.
So, I mean, I get, you know, it's, we've been mentioning, some people believe it's been working. I know it's only been a couple of years, but what sense do you get from what you're hearing? Do people there think it's working?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's obviously a mix. Like, I talked to a handful of people who were like, yeah, the schools are good. They're the same as they were before. Like, they didn't see too much of a difference. And then, you know, there are people like Anthony, there were a couple of people, students who spoke at legislative meetings over the past couple of years. One of them said, you know, Somerset taught us we have a chance at life. We are not just numbers. We actually mean something. And obviously, you just heard Anthony say, you know, Somerset saw good in me. And now, you know, people don't think we're the dumb kids they thought we were. So, I mean, you hearing that, you know, you're moved to hear a child say something like that. And you can see, like, the kind of difference you can make in a child's life when you restore hope and belief and faith in their future. However, you know, the school district had serious discipline problems for many years, and that obviously is not something that can change overnight.
Right.
And so, like you mentioned, there was a fight, a bunch of kids got arrested, and ultimately some of them were given this alternative to expulsion that was 45 days at home with a computer doing online education.
That was a fascinating aspect of the story, too. I won't give it away. I'll let people listen real quickly in the short time we have. Again, we said experiment, but do you think the rest of the state is watching to see, hey, maybe we can bring this here, do this here?
Yes. So first of all, I would say two things. One is, as far as like the financial emergency that we talked about and how the state came in and took over, definitely other school districts are looking at that and saying, wow, you know, the state can come in and just take over if we're not careful, if we don't make sure that we like keep everything in line as far as finances. And the state education commissioner recently made the suggestion, like, I would like a law where we can just directly take over struggling schools. So I think definitely school districts around the state are feeling that pressure of like a takeover. But as far as the effort being replicated, there is this Schools of Hope program where these new charter schools are coming in and getting extra funding. And there's already one in Miami, and there's going to be more in Tampa and Jacksonville over the next few years.
She is WLRN education reporter Jessica Bakeman. Again, her documentary Chartered, it airs again Thursday at 7 p.m. Go online, listen to it there, WLRN.org/chartered. Thank you, Jessica.
Thanks, Lewis.
All right, that's our program for this Tuesday, August 27th. Again, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial, or find us on WLRN.org. Just look up Sundial. We'll be back again tomorrow for more programming. We'll talk to you then.